Wisconsin Stories is a partnership of the Wisconsin Historical Society and Wisconsin Public Television.
Tonight, the city of Baraboo is hosting the American Legion Class AA State Tournament.
In Wisconsin, we play a lot of baseball. And like any sport, it's more than just a game.
It's part of local life. It's also part of what makes Wisconsin, Wisconsin.
From playing for fun to the big leagues, sports can tell us a lot about our history.
Tonight, we'll look back at some of the sports stories that have helped shape our state.
On Wisconsin Stories.
Funding for Wisconsin Stories is provided in part by an advised fund of the Community Foundation of Southern Wisconsin, the estate and family of Lois Backus, the Halbert and Alice Kadish Foundation, and Philip J. and Elizabeth B. Hendrickson, encouraging you to support history on Wisconsin Public Television and to visit Wisconsin's treasured historic sites.
In 1949, a professional basketball team from Sheboygan became a charter member of a new basketball league, the NBA. Now, how the heck did that happen? The 1930s were the barnstorming and dance hall days of basketball. Sheboygan fielded a series of locally sponsored industrial teams and became a basketball powerhouse, taking on the best teams in the country and winning. As the years went on, they established a record that would enable them to join the professional ranks. John Posowitz and his brothers started playing ball in the 1920s. His son, John, documented their team's history through family papers and photos.
Well, this is one of the earliest pictures I have of my dad and his brother, Joe. They were playing for the Sheboygan Merchants, and they played all the local teams. The year 1933 and 34, they went what they called independent, and that means that they went out and looked for other teams. Like they've got played Beloit Ferries, which is the Beloit Fairbanks Morris industrial team, the House of David, Cicero Elks, Green Bay Packers had a team.
Really?
And here's a notable one, the New York Wrens.
Well, they're like one of the great ball teams of all time.
Uncle Tony is the older brother. He's about 4 years older, and he played back in the 20s, but when the team went independent, he started to write to all these other teams and arrange for these games.
So he's setting up like a lot of these barnstorming teams to come through?
Setting up these barnstorming teams coming through. And I think that barnstorming era, this 1936 and 37, when they played as the Art Imigs and the Enzo Gels, were the most colorful time in basketball. You look down here, the Oshkosh All-Stars. The Oshkosh All-Stars were, well, when it all settled out, they played about 80-some games against the Sheboygan Redskins, and they ended up with about a 2- or 3-game edge over all these years of professional sports. This thing you want to look at, too, this is all the different teams in that league, and there are some dandies in there. I think there's every race, religion, culture, and everything else in here.
Well, the Bridgeport Jewish American Center, Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Yeah. Here's the Buffalo Bisons.
Chicago Colored Crusaders.
Chicago Colored Crusaders.
Dungeon Knights of Columbus, Iroquois Club of Garfield, New Jersey.
Then there's the King Klein All-Stars. They had a terrific year as the Enzo Gels in 1937. They won 17, lost 3, playing against all these Celtics and the Wrens and these people.
Wow.
They had a good year that year, so they were prime candidates for a franchise in this new league.
In the National Basketball League?
In the National Basketball League.
In 1938, the Enzo Gels turned pro and joined the NBL, taking on a new name, the Sheboygan Redskins. John Posowitz stayed to play for 2 more years with the team, which brought in a new coach, Frank Zumach. Zumach, a former Marquette University player, coached from 1938 to 1941 and stayed on in Sheboygan to practice law. Frank, where did the Redskins play in Sheboygan?
The Redskins, during my 3 years, played in the Eagles Hall right in downtown Sheboygan.
What was it like to play there?
There was a balcony around 3 of the sides. And if you got down in the corner. You couldn't shoot because it was up above you.
Did they have a dance floor there too?
Oh yes.
What was that like?
They waxed it, of course, for big bands that came in. And then when we got there, they didn't get all the wax off, so it was slippery. But if you played there often enough, you got the benefit of figuring it out a little bit.
So you had a little advantage with that?
We had an advantage, that's right.
What was it like in the town at the time? Was it big stuff to be with the Redskins?
Everybody was nuts about it. You wouldn't believe, but I can walk down the street today and all of somebody will yell, "Hi, coach." And that's 50, 60 years ago.
So they must have been pretty important to the town at the time.
Yes, it was. It really was.
This armory was built during the Great Depression as a WPA project, and it became the home of the Sheboygan Redskins.
The team filled the armory, and over 11 seasons, the Redskins won over half their games, including two Western Division titles and an NBL championship. So in 1949, Sheboygan was once again granted a franchise in a new basketball league, the NBA. But after only one season, Sheboygan and several other teams found they could no longer compete financially and were forced to leave the league. 6'7" Milt Schoon played center for the Redskins during their season in the NBA.
We brought a tape of the Sheboygan Redskins. I don't know who they're playing, but I want to show you and see what you think, okay?
Okay.
Let me give it a shot.
This is a tape of a game we played in the Sheboygan Armory. That was our home floor. In the black uniform, I believe that's the Indianapolis team, Alex Groza and a few more of the boys. There I am right there. Oops, too late. Notice the much slower style, more controlled ball than what they have today. Notice the large crowd in the stands, packed all the time. Max Morris with the ball, and there's me on the right.
Oh, okay.
There's Buddy Gilbertson, and that's Mike Todorovic.
So you're taking out the
there's
low ball.
There's Bobby Cook shooting a free throw.
He's shooting underhand.
The great two-hand underhand shot. That's what was popular in our day. Notice the stage at the end of the floor. One team would sit on one side and the other team on the other with the scorer's bench in between. Red Auerbach would bitch about that. See, there it's open at the other end of the field. Uh-huh. That's where the ushers and everybody always
but
stood.
But the crowd's right up to the line. The
crowd sits almost right on the line.
Oh, who's that?
There. Who's that?
Who's that?
Look at there. Two bits he misses.
He got it!
Oh, he made one!
He got it! Well, the place is packed.
With the people hollering, you ought to hear it. Oh, it was noisy. The referee would make a bad call. You'd think the roof was going to cave in. See the space between the stage and the playing floor?
There's
about
no
three
room.
Feet.
They have a couple padded mats under there. But
oh, yeah. They were about as hard as the floor. There goes
There's
one down
Kurt,
the floor.
Kurt White
now
pass.
you got to get him into the stage. That a boy. See, somebody
oh, yeah.
got him.
Oh, I think that was you.
No, what? I wouldn't do anything like that.
Oh, nice feed. Nice assist.
That's basically the way set somebody up so that, you know, somebody else is wide open.
There's no time clock. Shot clock.
No, you could.
No three-point play.
Game must be over. Sheboygan wins 75-73.
Well, it was
How
a
do
great
you like
game.
That? Boy, oh boy. Party tonight.
The familiar sounds of summer. Here, on the Bad River Indian Reservation near Ashland, they're sounds that help define community life. Traditionally, the Ojibwe were no strangers to games played with balls and sticks, especially this one. Lacrosse was the most popular game in North America before Europeans arrived. Missionaries who tried to convert the Ojibwe to Christianity in white ways discouraged the Indians from playing rough and tumble contests like lacrosse. They promoted kinder, gentler games such as baseball. The Ojibwe eventually embraced baseball, but only on their own terms.
Oh, we used to do our batting practice with lacrosse sticks, so.
Joe Rose played baseball here for the Odena Braves in the 40s and 50s.
get the lacrosse sticks out of the attic, and we knew that we could throw the ball a lot faster. In fact, I think you could throw it as fast as major league pitching with a lacrosse stick because of all the leverage you got.
Only not with much accuracy. He remembered playing an entire game with lacrosse sticks and a poor 12-year-old who got beaned by a high inside fastball.
Knocked him out cold. So then we went over, there was a pump over here, and we went over and we got some water and we poured on it on him and revived him. And when he got up, instead of allowing him to take first base because he got with a hit, we let him walk all the way around the home plate and score, and everyone was cheering. He felt real good, you know, because it was like hitting a home run, only he did it with his head.
As children, Joe Rose, Eugene Big Boy, and Eugene's cousin Arnold played here on the reservation's powwow grounds. Back then, it was a baseball field, like this one, where kids experienced the rites of spring, and older kids, if they were good enough, experienced the rites of passage, an invitation to play for the Odena Braves.
I started out playing when I was about 13 years old with them, really. I was pretty young kid yet, really.
For Eugene Big Boy, Braves baseball games were a chance to travel in the only vehicle the tribe owned, its dump truck.
Hey, can you picture a big dump truck coming in with a load of, especially Indian people and baseball team?
That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is.
The whole town would show up. Everyone in town would show up for Sunday ball
You'd
games.
You'd have people all the way to the trees over there, all the way up here, all the way back here.
A lot of them came to see Bill Nellis, a right-handed pitcher with a smoking fastball.
Who's the best pitcher? Who's the fastest pitcher? Fastball.
Nellis.
Nellis? What about curveball?
He must have thrown, he had curveball too. He had everything. He had a knuckler that would go like this.
Couldn't catch that thing, really.
And he was also the Braves' long ball hitter who could clear the trees from where we're standing. He became a legend, with teams throughout the Great Lakes vying for his services. On July 24, 1948, the city of Ashland honored him with Bill Nellis Day. But when it came to Native American baseball legends, there was nobody quite like the Chief.
Chief Bender pitched in 5 World Series for Connie Mack's Philadelphia.
Charles Albert Bender, Chief Bender as he was known, was the first Native American inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame and the first to have a set of baseball trading cards devoted to him. Bender, who played in the major leagues from 1903 until 1925, was a pitching ace for the Philadelphia Athletics. His best pitch was the one he invented, the slider, a pitch that came in fast and curved. On his way to a place in baseball history, Bender pitched in 5 separate World Series, winning 6 games, including a shutout. He was the American League's top pitcher 3 times, 1910, 1911, and 1914. Bender's achievements are a source of pride for many Ojibwe, including his family here at Bad River.
Oh, I knew about it when I was a child. You know, my father always told me about Chief Bender. So I knew about it just about all, as far as I can remember. To us, it's just more or less a legend, you know, and that's about all we really know about him.
Even when Bender wasn't pitching, baseball was front page news in the Odena Star, Bad River's Indian-owned newspaper of the era. In 1913, the Star enthusiastically covered every game played by the Odena Reds. Take its June 27th story on the game against Glidden, a game Odena won 6-2. Quote, "The first Glidden score was by an error, while the second came in the ninth by a lost ball," the Star sniffed. "The ball was hit in the raspberry bushes on the edge of the diamond and was lost, giving Glidden its second score on a lost ball." Some things never change. Balls still get lost in the raspberry bushes, and Bad River still turns out pitchers who can hit. The reservation no longer fields its own baseball teams. Little leaguers like Roy Whitebird are integrated throughout the league. Their grandfather says he sort of misses the old days.
Right now we don't have an organized baseball team here. We have a lot of softball players and stuff.
I think baseball itself, you know, not only lost itself here on Bad River, but it lost itself in all the small towns,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
That old baseball spirit, small town, anyhow, is not here anymore. You know, to play those games every Sunday, and it was something to look forward to.
Another Wisconsin sports story is boxing, UW-Madison collegiate boxing, which not only produced renowned champions, but also set national standards for the sport. I'm here in the UW Fieldhouse. For almost 30 years, this was the scene of a very successful collegiate boxing program. But as great was its glory, its demise was sudden and surprisingly final.
This bout in 1960 was one of the last ever held at the Fieldhouse. Remember these images, as it was the deciding match in the fate of UW boxing. But before we get to that, some background.
Please welcome the UW boxing team's parade of champions. In 24 seasons, as Wisconsin's boxing coach, he won 8 NCAA team titles and posted a dual meet record of 116 wins, 22 defeats, and 10 ties, escorted by athletic director Pat Richter. Please welcome Coach John Walsh.
We had very, very good success real good boys, and incidentally, they're all good scholars.
Boxing was so popular in Madison that a match in 1940 drew more than 16,000 fans to the Fieldhouse and a warning from the fire marshal.
It was completely oversold, and I was going up to check the ring, the ropes, to see how they were, which was my normal procedure, and somebody tapped me on the shoulder, and he says, "John, I'm the fire chief." He says, "And I'm a boxing fan." But he said, if you put in another crowd like this, I'm going to close you down and run like hell. And I said, excuse me very much. And he said, not tonight, though. We got a good match here. We'll go out with that.
Much of the secret to the success of the Badger boxing program can be attributed to Coach John Walsh. He molded the program into a close-knit community.
When John first came here, he was about the same age as the guys he was coaching. And they all had great respect for him. And to this day, they still have reunions among those guys.
Everybody respected John because everybody knew that he was such a great coach. First of all, he was a great boxer, an amateur boxer himself. And, when he talked, everybody listened because we all knew that he really knew what the heck he was talking about.
He had a profound influence on me. I didn't have a father, and I thought of John as my father figure, at least. More so after I got out of school and later, and we're still friends to this day.
A 1951 NCAA champion at 155 pounds, Dick Murphy.
Dick Murphy boxed for a strong Wisconsin program in the early 1950s. He was the NCAA champion in the 155-pound weight class in 1951.
One of the main reasons I came to Wisconsin was because of boxing, so I probably wouldn't have gotten a college education. First of all, I couldn't afford it. And coming up here and seeing the program and meeting the people, and I immediately was sold.
A teammate of Murphy's in the early 50s was Bob Morgan. Morgan says his move to Madison changed his life.
I found a home here for the first time, really. So, and I had been in high school. I was not very popular. I was a loner, and here I was part of something.
In 1952, Bob Morgan reached a peak when he won the NCAA championship at 147 pounds, and Morgan still remembers what it was like to box in the Fieldhouse.
I always hoped my opponent wouldn't show up, but he always showed up. You're all alone. I mean, coach is in your corner, and the trainers are there, and you've had all the training, but you're alone. And the waiting is what gets you before. And then the walk up the stairs when your knees are weak and It's just the feeling that, and the bell rings and everything's okay.
Although successful and popular, boxing was not without its critics. Many faculty members felt boxing should not be part of the university community, and there were increasing concerns about the safety of the sport, concerns that led to athletic department studies on the effects of boxing.
We had the boy in mind, and any time it was an uneven match, we referees told to stop the bout and so forth. And we had very, very, other than that one accident in 1960, that's the only serious one we had. We didn't even have broken hands and noses.
But in the spring of 1960, tragedy struck the Badger boxing program. Wisconsin's Charlie Moore fought a championship match in the field house against Stu Bartel of San Jose State. The referees stopped the fight. Charlie Moore lost.
He went into the locker room and collapsed there, and a week later he was deceased.
Some claim Moore died of an aneurysm, but the doctor who operated on Moore said Moore suffered a subdural hematoma, severe bleeding due to trauma.
But it was just one of those things that happened, and you don't know why.
Within days, the faculty at the university voted to ban boxing. The resolution said, quote, boxing was not an appropriate college sport, that it was brutal, with the sole intent to harm an opponent, unquote. Some said the faculty limited debate on the issue and called it a hasty decision.
And they just took a vote and abolished it.
They didn't consider it the sweet science, you know, that was. And I think they were, the faculty was just ready to pounce, and that did it. And it just about, for all intent and purposes, it killed big-time college boxing around the country.
When Wisconsin ended collegiate boxing in 1960, so did the rest of the schools across the country. But it is still remembered today.
I went fishing last year up in Minocqua, and I was in a bar having lunch. And I had maybe even had this shirt on in Wisconsin. The guy said, "You from Wisconsin?" I said, "Yeah." And he kept talking and talking about the boxing. He said, "Are you Ted Murphy?" Then you know, it's almost unbelievable how there's still people out there that remember the program because it was such a great program.
In 1976, the Madison West High School girls basketball team won the WIAA Division A state championship, and girls basketball became established as the interscholastic sport we know today. But it's a little known story that the first girls basketball tournament was held in 1925 and fueled a debate that ended competition between schools for nearly 50 years. A few days after the invention of the game of basketball in 1891, women at Smith College had adopted and modified the game. It soon spread to Wisconsin and became very popular with high school girls. This was a period of growing interest in women's health, and the free-moving game of basketball and its uniform were part of a rebellion against the restrictions of the Victorian era.
I'm at the Wisconsin Historical Society Collections area with Leslie Belay, who's the curator of costume and textiles. What kind of uniforms did girls wear playing basketball in the early 20th century?
Let me show you. This is an example from our collection. This is a gym suit. It's the bloomers.
Mm.
You can see the big bloomer legs.
Yeah.
It's made of wool serge. It's very scratchy.
Mm-hmm. Do you think for girls of that era, was this kind of a liberating costume?
Oh, definitely. For one thing, you did not have to wear a corset with it. In fact, some schools suggested very strongly that you did not wear your corset with it. But I think generally they thought this was a big improvement over their regular day clothes. You weren't hampered by skirts. You could run in these. You could jump. You could be physical. And I think a lot of girls were excited by that prospect.
By the 1920s, women had won the right to vote, and a newfound freedom showed in the uniforms and competitive play on the basketball court. It was a golden era for sports, but leaders in women's physical education questioned the wisdom of girls imitating men's sports. They worried that coaches were pushing girls to win at all costs, and that there might be serious health effects from the physical and mental strain of the game. In March of 1925, the Chippewa Falls Telegram sponsored Wisconsin's first girls' basketball tournament. Greenwood, displaying some classy ball handling and deadly shooting, easily took the title. The competition angered some sports leaders in the state. They charged that the girls were being pushed too hard, that some teams played as many as 6 games in 2 days, more than boys were allowed to play. After the Chippewa Falls tournament, the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association, or the WIAA, assumed control over high school girls' sports. In 1926, they voted to eliminate competition between schools. The girls were allowed to play out their existing schedules, and the ban would take effect at the beginning of the school year in 1927. Professor Emma Wilder, of what is now UW-La Crosse, was a state leader in girls' physical education. She sided with the WIAA in their decision and recommended less competitive intramural sports programs run by women that would allow more girls to play. Irene Ulrich was on the Mayville girls basketball team in 1926.
I had older brothers, and I always had to play with them. Every time they needed somebody to play with, Irene, come on.
See if you remember this.
You got Daniel?
I do. Look at this. Do you recognize that?
Oh, sure.
What were the games like?
We were the preliminary before the regular boys' games, you know. We had to entertain the people while they were waiting for the real game to start.
I have another annual. This one is from when you were a junior or a senior, and it says that the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association has forbidden high school girls to participate in the basketball games. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm. They thought that the basketball was too strenuous.
What did you feel like when they told you that you couldn't play basketball?
Well, how would you feel if somebody told you that you couldn't do something that you like to do?
There were hundreds of disappointed girls like Irene. It would be 50 years before high school girls were given a chance to compete in a statewide tournament, and girls' basketball, as we know it, was reborn.
Funding for Wisconsin Stories is provided in part by an advised fund of the Community Foundation of Southern Wisconsin, the estate and family of Lois Backus, the Halbert and Alice Kadish Foundation, and Philip J. and Elizabeth B. Hendrickson, encouraging you to support history on Wisconsin Public Television and to visit Wisconsin's treasured historic sites.